This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reporting the U.S. and Ukraine have signed a long-term security deal to help Kyiv's fight against Russia.
Minutes after he and President Biden finalized the pact in Italy, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky thanked him, but also raised a concern through an interpreter.
The question has to be for how long the unity will last.
Given the prospect of Donald Trump returning to the White House in November, the president tried to reassure Zelensky and Ukrainians.
They'll have what they need.
The agreement came as the president and other G7 leaders also cleared the way for a $50 billion loan package for Kyiv. He says those steps, plus new sanctions on Russia, send a signal to Vladimir Putin.
He cannot wait us out.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
United Nations agencies are trying to determine if famine should be officially declared in war-ravaged Sudan. We get more on the story from Reuters' David Doyle.
On Wednesday, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said 12 million people have been displaced in what is the world's largest humanitarian crisis.
People are dying from a lack of access to essential services and medicines.
The latest projection by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, states that between June and September, an estimated 756,000 people will be in Phase 5 catastrophe. That means the country has not yet reached famine, but is still considered a major crisis. In areas formerly designated as Phase 5 famine, more than 2 people per 10,000 are dying daily.
That was Reuters' David Doyle reporting. And as always, for details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. The U.S. Supreme Court rejected a bid by anti-abortion groups and doctors to restrict access to the abortion pill, handing a victory on Thursday to President Biden's administration in its efforts to preserve broad access to the drug. We get more from Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner.
It hands a victory to President Joe Biden's administration in its efforts to preserve broad access to the drug. And it marked defeat for the plaintiffs, who argued that the Food and Drug Administration acted contrary to its mandate to ensure medications are safe when it eased the restrictions on the drug. In a 9-0 decision authored by conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh, the court ruled that the plaintiffs behind the lawsuit lacked the necessary legal standing to pursue the case. A ruling in favor of the plaintiffs could have threatened the regulatory authority of the FDA over drug safety. The case represented another front in the intensifying battle over abortion rights in the United States.
That was Reuters' Freddie Joyner reporting. Sections of the southern Florida area are under flood emergencies right now, with heavy rainfall continuing into Friday, according to forecasters in the southern U.S. state. Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava told WPLG-TV on Thursday the county is working to pump water out of flooded streets, but urges residents not to drive on them.
We're advising people, please stay home if you possibly can, and do not go wandering into flooded waters. You just do not know what's under that water, and especially if there's power lines down, which we know a lot of power is out, 10,000 customers approximately in Miami-Dade. So we want people to just stay off the road. But we are pumping, and we also have our emergency vehicles on the ready.
The heavy storms moving across Florida is occurring nearly the same time and as the early June area start of the hurricane season, which is forecast to be very active this year. U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Dick Durbin says his committee has uncovered at least 3 additional luxury trips given to Justice Clarence Thomas by donors as part of the panel's ethics investigation to the Supreme Court. Durbin saying Thursday the committee obtained information from Republican mega donor Harlan Crow that Thomas took 3 trips on Crow's private jet that were given to him in 2017, 2019, and 2021. While a man from Fort Worth, Texas, here in the U.S., charged on Thursday threatening to jail or slaughter an FBI agent over the criminal case against President Biden's son, Hunter. According to the criminal complaint, Timothy Mueller, on June 11, called the FBI agent who had been assigned to the laptop case belonging to Biden. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
10-year security agreement.
Our goal is to strengthen Ukraine's credible defense and deterrence capabilities for the long term.
Tesla gives Elon Musk the largest CEO pay package in U.S. corporate history.
Musk is kind of the company. He developed Tesla, joined shortly after the company was started, and turned it into, from nothing, to the world's largest electric vehicle maker.
And the wild giant panda population is growing.
Efforts to reintroduce captive bred giant pandas into the wild are working, and their population is growing.
Today is Friday, June 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman.
President Zelensky and I have just now signed that agreement between the United States and Ukraine.
U.S. President Joe Biden and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky signed a 10-year bilateral security agreement on Thursday aimed at bolstering Ukraine's defense against Russian invaders and getting Ukraine closer to NATO membership.
A lasting peace for Ukraine must be underwritten by Ukraine's own ability to defend itself now and to deter future aggression anytime in the future. The United States is going to help ensure that Ukraine can do both, not by sending American troops to fight in Ukraine, but by providing weapons and ammunition, expanding intelligence sharing, continuing to train brave Ukrainian troops at bases in Europe and the United States.
The deal, signed on the sidelines of the G7 summit in Italy, aims to commit future U.S. administrations to support Ukraine, even if former President Donald Trump wins November's election, according to White House officials. Also on Thursday, all of the G7 countries committed to a loan package worth about 50 billion euros to Ukraine, backed by proceeds from immobilized Russian assets. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen.
It is a strong signal that we are sending to Ukraine that we will support Ukraine in its fight for freedom for as long as it takes. It is also a strong signal to Putin that Putin cannot outlast us. You should keep in mind that there's a European support of 50 billion euros, there's the American support of $60 billion, and now comes on top a G7 package of $50 billion. And the message is also that it's not the European taxpayers that are paying for the damage that Putin is causing with this war of aggression, but it is Putin.
So let's go deeper on this. Joining us now to talk about it is Sergei Sanovich, a Hoover Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. So the United States and Ukraine signed a 10-year increased security agreement today. What does that really mean for Ukraine, do you think?
My view is that this agreement with U.S. and previously with Japan, with many European countries, they ensure success in the case of victory, broadly defined. So even if it's a negotiated settlement that limits Ukrainian territorial losses and guarantees the security of the part of Ukraine that that it controls, this will make sure that Ukraine will succeed in its original goal. They just wanted to build a successful European democracy aligned with United States and NATO.
Also, one of the stated goals was, President Biden said, getting them to the point where they can make their own munitions as well, right?
They have teams that are now working with producers of weapons from NATO countries, Rheinmetall, German military conglomerate. They opened recently a facility inside Ukraine. And, Central Bank is working, I think, pretty effectively.
You know, the other thing that that strikes me about Zelensky is that, you know, he's conducting a war, you know, running the country, rebuilding infrastructure as it gets destroyed. And he is like on a roadshow constantly pitching Ukraine to partners, partner nations. He's out there glad-handing, striking deals, cajoling countries to be on his side, on Ukraine's side, getting weapons from them, getting commitments. I don't remember an instance like this in another country that was fighting a war and really working the room the way he does.
I would agree with you. I think this is sort of Ukraine didn't have the option to postpone this this work until after victory. They had to modernize the country at the same time when Russia is trying to destroy it. This is, you know, this infrastructure agency, this, you know, they are working with international partners to improve the transportation system in Ukraine, whether it's roads or ports or airports. But all of that, of course, is critical for military logistics. So it's not something that would be needed in the future. It is, you know, the need is now. And it also applies to the foreign policy. You know, Ukraine, again, I think this sort of its investment in the future state capacity and international clout, which, you know, Ukraine has a great potential. Pre-war population was bigger than Poland, and it has some unique assets. Recently, I think Senator Graham or somebody in the U.S. Senate discovered that Ukraine has big deposits of critical minerals, and you know, they are saying that it's important that, you know, it's not Russia that benefits its allies, right? So it can be an important international player, not just, Zelensky outreach is not just to the allied nations and partners in Europe and U.S. and Canada, but also he recently met with Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. He's even trying to, you know, find some common ground with China. And, you know, in terms of, you know, China restricting Russian cyber-attacking using nuclear threat of nuclear weapons, you know, helping with release of children that were captured by Russia, which is would be a big important topic in this conference in Switzerland. Also, I think he's trying to push China from selling weapons to Russia. So this, you know, I think Ukraine demonstrates quick acquiring of the capacity to, you know, defend itself not just militarily, which they impressed the whole world with, but also on a diplomatic stage, including in not necessarily the most friendly environments in the Middle East and Asia. So again, this it's, it may be not a decisive contribution, but it's an important contribution. Both to strengthen Ukraine's hand on the battlefield, if there would be negotiations at negotiating table, and then succeeding in realizing all this great potential that Ukraine has.
Thank you so much for the time.
A pleasure to talk to you as always.
Sergei Sonovich, a Hoover Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Samford University. Following these other stories from around the world, a unanimous U.S. Supreme Court on Thursday preserved access to an abortion drug that was used in nearly two-thirds of abortions in the U.S. last year. It marked the court's first abortion decision since conservative justices overturned Roe v. Wade 2 years ago. Hezbollah said it has launched rockets and weaponized drones at 9 Israeli military sites in a coordinated attack on Thursday, ramping up hostilities on Lebanon's southern border for the second consecutive day. Tesla shareholders approved CEO Elon Musk's $56 billion pay package, a big thumbs up to his leadership and an enticement for keeping his focus on his biggest source of wealth. It is the largest CEO pay package in U.S. corporate history. In our our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, a U.S. president can serve a maximum of 8 years. It's written into the law. So whether Joe Biden or Donald Trump is victorious in November, it would be their final term. Trump, however, is musing about a possible third term. From Washington, VOA's chief national correspondent, Steve Herman, explains.
Campaigning for a second term, Donald Trump asked America's largest gun lobby last month about whether he might get a third term, referencing the four terms of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who died in office in 1945.
FDR, 16 years, almost 16 years, he was four term. I don't know, are we going to be considered three term or two term? You tell me, Ronnie, what do you think?
Congress in 1947 approved the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution, limiting presidents to just a pair of four-year terms. That became law in 1951, after the amendment was ratified by the necessary 36 of the then 48 states.
The amendment really codifies what had been for a long time a political norm of not running for more than two terms.
That's Praveen Fernandez, vice president of the Constitutional Accountability Center. He explains the two-term tradition goes back to America's first president, George Washington, who ignored repeated pleas to run for a third term. With the start of the Second World War, Franklin Roosevelt broke with that tradition in 1940 and won a fourth term in 1944 as well.
I, Barack Hussein Obama.
Since the 22nd Amendment, six presidents have served two full terms, the most recent being Barack Obama. A prominent supporter for President Joe Biden, actor Robert De Niro, labels Trump a tyrant who wants to be president for life.
If he gets in, I can tell you right now, he will never leave. He will never leave. You know that. He will never leave.
I only want to be a dictator for one day.
Such declarations by Trump in this election cycle come as he faces criminal charges for attempting to overturn the 2020 election results. And that may presage future intent, according to constitutional attorney Fernandez.
The comments that Donald Trump recently made about a third term, which of course flies right in the face of clear constitutional text, are another reason to have concerns about someone who doesn't feel constrained by the clear text of our laws.
The President of the United States.
For Trump to legally pursue a third term, the 22nd Amendment would have to be repealed, and that would require a two-thirds vote in both chambers of Congress, and then ratification by at least 38 of the 50 states. Or 34 states could call a constitutional convention, and any action they approve would have to be ratified by 38 states. Only once in American history has a constitutional amendment been repealed.
Acting Secretary of State William Phillips is signing the 21st Amendment, and prohibition is repealed.
The 21st Amendment, ratified in 1933, annulled the unpopular and frequently violated 18th Amendment, which in 1919 banned alcoholic beverages. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Indonesia's defense minister, Prabowo Subianto, is set to be sworn in as the country's next president in October after having resoundingly won elections in February. VOA's Virginia Gunawan reports what this means for U.S. relations with Southeast Asia's largest country.
Analysts say Indonesia's incoming president, Prabowo Subianto, will likely move the country in a new direction. Indonesia's current president, Joko Widodo, a former businessman, has been focusing his two terms in office on building the country's infrastructure. But Prabowo, a U.S.-trained retired general and Indonesia's defense minister, might have different approach. Ahmad Rizky Umar is an Indo-Pacific researcher at the University of Queensland in Australia. He says Indonesia's military is behind in modernizing its defense equipment, and this could be Prabowo's priority.
Indonesia is a little behind in modernizing its defense equipment.
If defense equipment modernization becomes the focus for Prabowo, this will mark a change.
As an active military member, Prabowo received military training in the U.S. in the 1980s. In 1998, he was barred from entering the U.S. due to alleged human rights abuses. However, that restriction was recently waived, and since 2019, the defense minister has made several visits to the U.S., securing billions of dollars worth of arms sales, including F-15 fighter jets. Brian Harding is a senior analyst for Southeast Asia at the United States Institute of Peace.
I think President-elect Prabowo certainly has his history with the United States, but there's also just a positivity in the relationship. And he's personally overseen a real development in the defense relationship over the last 5 years as defense minister. And we'll just have to see where this goes.
Last month, 1,300 service members from the Indonesian and U.S. Navy and Marine Corps completed Cooperation Afloat and Readiness Training, or CARAT, a biennial maritime exercise in Bandar Lampung on the island of Sumatra. Though held amid rising tension between countries in the region and China, the Indonesian Navy says the exercises have no relation to regional developments. Rear Admiral Yos Suryono Hadi says the exercise is merely to increase the professionalism of service members and not related to the South China Sea. Moreover, he says U.S.-Indonesian relations have long occurred and that CARAT isn't its 30th year.
It has nothing to do with the South China Sea. Indonesia and the U.S. have long had relations, and the CARAT exercise is now in its 30th year, and it will be better in the future.
While China plays a significant role in the region's economy and trade, analysts note the Southeast Asian countries, including Indonesia, see the U.S. as a more reliable partner in defense cooperation. Again, Brian Harding.
But the reality is that countries looking to develop their militaries, professionalization, interoperability, they're looking to the United States, they're looking to their own immediate neighborhood, they're looking to Japan and Australia much more than they are as it relates to China.
According to the Lowy Institute, from 2021 to 2023, the U.S. has participated in nearly 180 joint military exercises with Southeast Asian countries, more than any other country and many more than the 46 conducted with China. Virginia Gunawan, VOA News, Washington.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Floodwaters raged in Spain's Murcia after torrential rains led to flooding in several Spanish cities. Heavy rains in central and southern Chile have resulted in one death and left 4,000 people homeless, with thousands of homes damaged, according to reports on Thursday. And torrential downpours deluged South Florida on Thursday in the United States, with some areas getting up to 46 to 63.5 centimeters of rain. Since Monday, a Russian Navy frigate and a nuclear-powered submarine sailed into Havana Harbor on Wednesday, a stopover that both the United States and Cuba said posed no threat, but which was widely seen as a Russian show of force as tensions rise over the Ukraine war. Associated Press correspondent Norman Hall reports the U.S. Navy has responded.
A U.S. Navy submarine has arrived in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, in a show of force as a fleet of Russian warships gather for planned military exercises in the Caribbean. U.S. Southern Command said the USS Helena, a nuclear-powered fast attack submarine, pulled into the waters near the U.S. base in Cuba on Thursday. U.S. ships have been tracking and monitoring the Russian drills. Pentagon officials also say they do not represent a threat. I'm Norman Hall.
The United States has granted the Maka Indian tribe in Washington state a long-sought waiver that helps clear the way for its first sanctioned whale hunts since 1999. The Maka is a tribe of about 1,500 people on the northwestern tip of the Olympic Peninsula and is the only American Indian tribe with a treaty that specifically mentions a right to hunt whales. They've been fighting this in court for 20 years. Thursday's decision allows the tribe to hunt up to 25 Eastern North Pacific gray whales over 10 years. And finally, giant pandas
are making a comeback in the wild. Chinese scientists at a giant panda sanctuary say efforts to introduce the captive-bred bears back into the wild are paying off, and that the wild giant panda population is growing. Here's Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan with this story.
Efforts to reintroduce captive-bred giant pandas into the wild are working, and their population is growing. That's according to Chinese scientists at a giant panda sanctuary in Yan'an in southwestern Sichuan province. Since 2003, China has successfully reintroduced 12 captive giant pandas into the wild. 10 of the 12 survived. Forest engineer Yang Xi says his team was thrilled to capture the first images of a giant panda with its cub on infrared cameras.
Previously, there were only 28 wild giant pandas in this area, according to survey data. Now, with the giant pandas having cubs, it proves that our conservation is effective and their numbers are gradually increasing.
Scientists say the carefully selected captive giant pandas are released to mate with wild pandas in order to ensure that genetic diversity increases. China has established 67 giant panda nature reserves as of July 2023. China's National Forestry and Garden Administration says those reserves are effectively protecting over 60% of wild giant panda population.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for being with us during this time. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. We also have apps. You can download them from Apple and Google. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In 2013, the Assad regime released deadly sarin gas on Syrian civilians in the Ghouta district of Damascus. More than 1,400 people, many of them children, were killed. A month later, after an international chorus of condemnation and outrage, Syria joined the Chemical Weapons Convention and pledged not only to never use chemical weapons, but also committed to the prohibition on their development, production, stockpiling, and transfer. Tragically, as UN Alternative Representative Robert Wood pointed out at a recent Security Council briefing, for the past decade, multiple independent investigations have concluded the Assad regime repeatedly used chemical weapons against its own people.
Still, the Assad regime has yet to fully account for or destroy its chemical weapons arsenal, nor has it accepted responsibility for the atrocities these weapons caused.
For this reason, the United States welcomes the ongoing work of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, which is the implementation arm of the Chemical Weapons Convention. The OPCW continues to investigate Syria's residual chemical weapons capabilities in the face, as Ambassador Wood noted, of the Assad regime's continued obfuscation.
The United States has long been concerned the Syrian regime retains residual chemical weapons capability, and indeed, the OPCW continues to uncover new alarming evidence. Last month, the Director General reminded OPCW states parties of the presence of unexpected chemicals in samples collected by the Declaration Assessment Team between 2021 and 2023 across several declared sites. Such results clearly demonstrated the Assad regime has neither declared nor accounted for the full history and scope of its chemical weapons program.
Ambassador Wood praised the decision by the OPCW Conference of States recommending that states' parties take collective measures to prevent the transfer to Syria of dual-use chemicals and equipment.
This decision also aims to prevent the same dual-use chemicals and equipment from falling into the hands of non-state actors, including terrorist groups.
The United States, Ambassador Wood declared, will continue working with partners across the world to bring an end to the regime's chemical weapons program and promote accountability for the use of chemical weapons in Syria and elsewhere.
That was an editorial reflecting